All right, the wait is over. We've received your letters, and round six of 3-Minute Fiction is now open here on the weekends on All Things Considered. We've got a new judge and a new challenge to start off the new year. Now, if you've missed any of the previous rounds or you're not familiar with the contest, it's pretty simple. We're looking for original short fiction that can be read in under 3 minutes, so the story can't be longer than 600 words. And each round, we have a new judge who throws out a challenge. Last time, it was the novelist Michael Cunningham, and he asked that each story begin, "Some people swore that the house was haunted." And we saw a record-breaking number of entries in that last round, over 5,000 original stories. Now it's time for round six, and with me is our newest judge to take the helm. It's the novelist and short story writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the author of the critically acclaimed books Purple Hibiscus and Half of a Yellow Sun. Chimamanda, are you there?
I am, yes.
Thank you so much for agreeing to judge this round. We are so excited about this.
It's my pleasure.
And I should say it's particularly exciting to have you do this contest because your last book, and we actually interviewed you on the program about this book, was a collection of short stories. What have you been up to since we last spoke?
I have been pretending to be working on a new novel.
You say pretending because?
Well, because I'm always terrified about talking about work in progress, because then it means there's something, there's a kind of terrifying certainty about it, because then people expect you to produce a book in a year or two, and then when you don't, they wonder why you talked about working on a book. So I think it's just safer to say that I'm supposed to be working on a book, and I'm pretending to be working on a book, just in case nothing results in the end.
But in the meantime, you had some great news. This year, you had a piece that came out in a book published by the New York. It was called 20 Under 40, so 20 stories by authors under the age of 40. And your story in there was called Birdsong. That story was actually singled out by Alan Chews, who's the book reviewer for All Things Considered during the week. Can you tell us about that story?
Birdsong is set in Lagos in Nigeria. And for a long time, I've wanted to write a story in which the city of Lagos itself is a character. Because it's such a fascinating city in its extremes and its contradictions, and also I wanted to write about what it is to be a young female, youngish really, sort of late 20s and early 30s, walking in a city like Lagos and then falling in love with a man who isn't necessarily right for you. So really, the story is about things I had observed, some personal experiences, and very much wanting to try and capture Lagos in a story.
Chimamanda, as somebody who has written a lot of short fiction, what do you make of the challenge of writing something under 600 words that has to be read in 3 minutes?
I think it's a really difficult thing to do well and to pull off, as the Americans would say. But also it's interesting because what it forces you to do is that it forces you to go down to the essentials and to what really matters. Because sometimes you find that stories have a lot of padding. I, for example, know that sometimes before I read, my story is allowed at readings, I find myself editing with a pencil.
You mean editing things that have already been published?
Yes, and then you start to think, well, maybe this doesn't actually belong in the story. Maybe this is superfluous. So I think that writing a story in 600 words is a challenge, but I think it's a fantastic thing for a writer because it really forces you to make choices about what the story really needs and what really matters and what's essential.
Well, I think you're the perfect judge for this competition, and you're following in a long line of illustrious judges, James Wood and Michael Cunningham and Ann Patchett and Alan Chews. As we've done with each round, Chimamanda, we asked you to come up with a challenge for round six of 3-Minute Fiction. And so, as you know, in previous rounds, the stories had to include certain words like plant and button. Last round, each story had to begin, "Some people swore that the house was haunted." And I can tell you, after reading through thousands of stories that begin with "some people swore that the house was haunted," I never want to read that line again. What's your challenge? What are you throwing out to our listeners this round?
The challenge this round is that one character must tell a joke and one character must cry at some point in the story. And it can be the same character who does both, but crying and telling a joke must be done.
So in those 600 words, a joke has to be told and somebody has to cry. It can be the same person, and the crying doesn't necessarily have to be sad crying.
No, it doesn't. No, certainly not.
Why these two different emotions? Why crying and laughter?
Well, I think for one thing, I find that I'm sort of very unapologetically old-fashioned in my tastes in fiction, which is that in fiction, I'm interested in character and in emotion. I think that's really, for me, what fiction is about. And I think the ability to cry and the ability to laugh, for me, is in some ways what defines our humanity. And, you know, joy and sorrow, really. Mm. I find that I'm drawn to fiction that can do both. And to try and do that in 600 words, I think, would just be very interesting to see.
So what are you going to be looking for in these stories, Chimamanda?
I'm hoping I will be entertained. But really, again, just the idea of a story that tries to grapple with human emotion. Mm. I would also like to see character. It would be lovely if there was an inventive use of language. It would be fantastic if all three were done, but also it would be unusual.
I think that you're going to have to actually try this challenge yourself.
I often say no to judging fiction because I think it's a really difficult thing to do. I think that fiction, you know, that for me, literature is this huge house with so many different rooms and there's so many different styles of writing that it's so difficult to judge and say this is better than that, right? But the wonderful thing about having an opportunity to judge something like this, which is, you know, more fun than the usual judging, is that I don't have to do it myself because I'm not sure that I could do it well, actually,
right,
if I did it myself.
You're going to have people from this program helping you out, and so we're going to narrow those stories down. You're not going to have to read the thousands that will come in, but you'll read, you know, several hundred of them, so not an easy task.
No, but one that I think will be exciting and interesting and also hopefully will nurture my own writing.
That's actually a good point. All right, so let's recap, Chimamanda. This is round six of 3 Minute Fiction, and it is now open. We are accepting submissions until, let me check here, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, January 23rd. We have to be able to read your stories out loud in 3 minutes or less, so no more than 600 words per story. And Chimamanda, just remind us one more time of the challenge for this round.
One character must tell a joke, and one character must cry.
Okay, one character has to tell a joke, one character has to cry. There is only one entry allowed per person. To send in your story, go to our website. That's npr.org/3MinuteFiction. That's 3 Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. You can find the full rules at our website as well. And as in previous rounds, we'll be posting some of our favorites on the website each week as we begin to narrow it down. We'll be checking in with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie every few weeks as well to find out which stories have caught her eye. The winning story will be read on the air in its entirety, and the winner will receive a signed copy of Chimamanda's book, The Thing Around Your Neck. So Chimamanda, any final words of advice before listeners decide whether or not to get in there?
I think they should just have fun with it and not take it too seriously, because sometimes the best fiction comes out from a very light touch.
That's the author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the judge of round six of our 3 Minute Fiction contest, which is now open. Chimamanda, thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, to submit your story, visit our website, npr.org/3MinuteFiction. That's all spelled out with no spaces.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Labor Department says the U.S. economy gained 103,000 jobs in December, and the unemployment rate fell to 9.4% from 9.8%. That might sound like good news, but many economists hoped to see much stronger job growth. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
To make the most of the increase in jobs, President Obama yesterday held a news conference at a window factory in Landover, Maryland. It's been hiring on workers. The president spoke after going on a tour of the business, Thompson Creek Manufacturing.
Thompson Creek was able to grow its workforce from 200 employees to nearly 300 employees in just 1 year.
The president said that his administration has been enacting policies to try to promote job growth, such as tax credits for businesses that hire workers.
We also passed a tax credit for products like energy-saving windows, and that led to a 55% boost in the sales at this firm.
Looking back over the past year at hiring around the country, the president was upbeat.
The trend is clear. We saw 12 straight months of private sector job growth. That's the first time that's been true since 2006. The economy added 1.3 million jobs last year. And each quarter was stronger than the previous quarter, which means that the pace of hiring is beginning to pick up.
Still, a snail moves faster when it comes out of its shell and starts oozing forward. And the jobs growth picture hasn't been improving much more quickly than that.
Improving, but not great.
Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at IHS Global Insight. He was not too excited by the 103,000 jobs that the economy gained in December.
This number was a little disappointing because we and a lot of other people expected it to be closer to 200,000. But the good news is businesses are feeling more optimistic. All the surveys of business sentiment suggest that businesses are feeling better about things. They are going to hire, but it certainly looks like they're still hiring at a fairly slow pace.
The problem is that the economy needs to add around 150,000 jobs every month just to keep pace with population growth and people coming back into the workforce. And while we may have gained a million jobs last year, as the president said, the country lost nearly 8.5 million jobs the 2 years prior. So that level of job growth is
a pace insufficient to materially reduce the unemployment rate.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke about this at a hearing in D.C. on Friday. His comments seemed to throw some cold water on the optimism being expressed by the Obama administration. He said the members of the Federal Open Market Committee are estimating just how long it will take for most out-of-work Americans to get back to work.
Most participants expected the unemployment rate to be close to 8% 2 years from now. At this rate of improvement, it could take 4 to 5 more years for the job market to normalize fully.
That's a pretty disheartening prediction. Michael Linden is an economist with the liberal-leaning think tank, the Center for American Progress.
So this actually speaks to the ludicrousness, that's not really a word, the craziness of laying anybody off on the public side right now.
Most economists agree that the country needs a credible plan to reduce the federal deficit, and that will likely mean cutbacks in government spending. But in the short term, some economists are calling for even more spending to prop up local and state governments so that they don't have to lay off more people and make the unemployment problem even worse. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. New year, new Congress, same old health care debate. At least that's how it sounded on the House floor yesterday. The new Republican majority started the process to repeal last year's sweeping health care overhaul. It's one of their top priorities. NPR's Julie Robner reports on the preliminary round.
As the House settled in to debate the rule that would set up next Wednesday's big vote, there were a lot of new faces, but the arguments they made had a familiar ring to them. Here's Republican freshman Richard Nugent of Florida.
Everybody knows that the health care system is broken and that reform is needed. However, the unconstitutional, job-killing mandates of Obamacare are not the answer.
Democrats are countering those arguments with a spirited defense of their own. They're focusing on some of the more popular provisions that are already in effect and helping their constituents. California Congresswoman Doris Matsui talked about a young woman in her district who couldn't get insurance because she had a thyroid problem. The law helped her get back on her parents' health plan. She also talked about a senior named Gary who's getting help with his drug costs because he falls into the so-called donut hole in Medicare prescription drug coverage.
Repeal would mean that Gary and the thousands of other seniors in my district would see no relief from this Part D donut hole. This is unacceptable.
Much of the debate on the repeal yesterday, though, centered on the cost of the massive law to the federal budget, just like it did last year when the law first passed. Democrats argued then and now that the law is more than fully paid for. It actually reduces the deficit. And the Congressional Budget Office, Congress's official scoring referee, agreed. So it was no surprise that on Thursday, CBO said repealing the law would add to the deficit. Specifically, it said it would add around $230 billion over the next 10 years. But Republicans, like Indiana's Mike Pence, scoff at that notion.
Only in Washington, D.C. could you say you were going to spend trillions of dollars and save people money. And this morning, only in Washington, D.C., could you say that repealing a $2.7 trillion dollar government takeover of health care is actually going to cost money.
So Republicans have simply decided to ignore CBO when it comes to the health care law. They've exempted this bill from new rules that would otherwise require offsetting budget cuts for any bill that adds to the deficit. That's brought charges of hypocrisy from Democrats, including Rules Committee ranking member Louise Slaughter.
Estimates provided by the CBO are the singular authoritative figures upon which we make all of our decisions and have for decades. Even if some don't like what the numbers tell us, we know that numbers don't lie.
But House Majority Leader Eric Cantor says he doesn't really blame the CBO. He blames the Democrats for giving the CBO bad numbers to work with.
CBO scores what's put in front of them. There's nothing that has changed about the flawed assumptions underlying the old score of the Obamacare bill. Only the dates have changed. This is the same gimmicks producing more false deficit reduction and, in fact, real spending increases.
But whether the repeal bill increases the deficit or not doesn't really matter, because it's not likely to get very far after it passes the House next week. Democratic leaders in the Senate say they won't take it up in that chamber, and President Obama has already vowed to veto it in the unlikely event it reaches his desk. So why are Republicans pursuing what they know is basically a symbolic action? Because they said they would. Here's how House Rules Committee Chairman David Dreyer put it.
The commitment was made that we would have an up or down vote on repeal, and that's exactly what we are doing.
And that vote is now scheduled for next Wednesday, after 7 more hours of debate. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A few years ago, an IBM computer beat Garry Kasparov in a chess match. The question is, can a computer become a Jeopardy champion? IBM seems pretty confident it can. 4 years ago, the company started work on a computer they call Watson, and programmers have been fine-tuning it ever since. And in about a month, Watson will make its debut appearance on Jeopardy, playing against two of the most formidable players of all time. David Ferrucci is IBM's chief scientist behind Watson.
What Watson will appear like to the audience is essentially a screen of some form where there's a design on that screen, and it reacts to Watson's different states, whether it's sort of thinking or speaking, and that's all you'll see at the podium. Off stage are the actual computers, the hardware that is trying to understand and answer the questions.
How does Watson know the answers? I mean, there are an infinite number of topics, questions that could be asked. I mean, is he just loaded with information? Does he have access to infinite data?
No, it doesn't. In fact, Watson, when it plays Jeopardy, is completely self-contained.
Not connected to the internet.
Not connected to the internet. Moreover, I mean, think about it. Even if you were connected to the internet and you looked at the top 10, 20 documents, let's say the answer was in there somewhere, how do you know what the right answer
right.
is? You have to have a deeper understanding. And that's where all the sort of the analytics come in, these algorithms that run on this hardware to analyze all that data from lots of different dimensions to decide, I think this answer is more right than this other one, and I'm going to compute sort of a probability.
David, let me play a clip of Watson. This is a sort of a trial run on Jeopardy, answering the question correctly.
You got to know when to hold him, know when to fold him. On July 28th, 1994, this Texas Ranger with a familiar name did. Watson?
What is Kenny Rogers?
That is correct. Select again, Watson.
He's talking about Kenny Rogers, a baseball player, not Kenny Rogers, the singer who sang that song. So that was a trick question. How did Watson figure that out?
Watson looks at the different parts of the clue and looks at the date, looks at the names, looks at the times that are referred to, and pieces it all together. So it may find many, many documents that refer to these various elements in the clue. So it's got to knit all those pieces of information together.
But there are cases when he gets it wrong. For example, there's the question to identify the people with the initials LB in the REM song, It's the End of the World as We Know It. And here's how Watson replied.
In REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It, two of the men with the initials LB. Watson?
What is I Feel Fine?
Ooh, no.
I Feel Fine is a lyric in the song,
right.
David. And as an REM fan, I should say the answer was it could have been Lester Bangs, Lenny Bruce, Leonard Brezhnev, Leonard Bernstein. Have you guys worked out the kinks?
So I guess Watson's not an REM fan.
No, he's not an REM fan. But they listen to this show, so they're not going to be happy to hear that.
But I think that's one where it's really not understanding the clue, it's not interpreting the need for those initials, or it's not weighing that enough. And this is an example of Watson looking again at sort of many different dimensions of the clue and what it's reading and analyzing, putting it all together. And in the end, the net isn't favoring the right answer.
So now you guys are clearly confident in all the refining you've done over the years that you're taking Watson to Jeopardy. You're going to put it up against two of the best Jeopardy players of all time. Ken Jennings, he had the longest winning streak. Brad Rutter, he won the most money. Who should I put my money on?
Well, I couldn't tell. That wouldn't be fair if I told you that. What I could tell you is that Watson wins and loses. We've played a series of 55 sparring matches here at IBM against former 20-minute champion players. And while we can't release that record yet, I can tell you that, you know, Watson did well enough to give it this television debut. I could also tell you it won and it lost. So it's going to be an interesting, and I think, at least for me, edge of my seat contest.
That's David Ferrucci, the scientist who led the team that created the IBM computing system Watson, which is set to appear on Jeopardy next month. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Police logs in the newspaper are often kind of dull, names, dates, and a terse description of the crime committed, usually about all you get. But the Rochester Times police log is packed with poetry and puns. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Listen to this.
At Halloween upon a street where youngsters go for trick-or-treat, a worried parent calls the cops. His kid's been handed Hall's cough drops. A curiosity has gripped us, cherry mint or eucalyptus. Dad makes the point it's medication and not the stuff of celebration. Please check out this plot of terror and find it was a simple error.
John Nolan writes the police log and edits the Rochester Times. He's delivered tales of odd and scary behavior for some 22 years now, some of it with his signature puns, some of it in rhyme. But Nolan used to write it like everyone else.
Kind of tedious and dreadful.
So one night, he decided to try a little experiment.
I wrote a dog barks on Ten Rod Road, and I added deep in the forest a berry drops, because I'd been reading some Japanese haikus, so that was in my mind.
Managing editor Rod Doherty says he's a little surprised just how popular Nolan's police log is.
If it doesn't appear, I will start to hear from people, where's the Rochester police log? Because I sit there thinking, hey, we put all this other news in the paper all the time, and you're calling up because the police log's not in there.
On Winter Street, a lady pushes a gentleman through a window to air a grievance.
Some readers point out these are serious issues, not jokes. That line about airing a grievance makes you smile until you think about what happened. Was that sexual assault? Was it a break-in? To a certain extent, Nolan agrees with the sentiment. After 17 years as a Glasgow, Scotland cop, he understands the ugliness of crime. But he says it's that job that taught him how to cope.
You'd see the very worst of behavior, but it was always lightened a little bit or softened by sort of gallows humor. That's how people get by.
Nolan doesn't just want people to chuckle. He's using crime to tell a story about how people live together.
5:47 p.m. With only a crescent moon, teens have to fight under a streetlight. 1:27 a.m. The people in the raucous Granite Street apartment are at it again, banging on walls and yelling louder than ever. 8:12 p.m. Spring has arrived. A bike is stolen from a Charles Street driveway.
Nolan thinks one reader nailed it when he said the log is gritty, with the self-confidence to poke fun at its own goings-on. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
In a different part of town, there is another cause to frown. Trick-or-treaters all are shocked, for after a man's door is knocked, he answers it not how he should. He keeps appearing in the nude.
This is NPR News. This week's announcement by New South Books that it's publishing a new edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, in which a racial slur that begins with the letter N is replaced with the word slave, stirs up conflicting reactions. On the one hand, the effrontery, the vapid, smiley-faced effrontery, as the great Twain biographer Ron Powers put it, to replace a word that a genius pointedly used more than 200 times when he wrote the book in 1885, seems a bit like covering the large gaping wounds shown in Picasso's Guernica with Band-Aids. But there are already scores of editions in print in which the N-word appears, and every year, it seems, some school district somewhere refuses to read Huckleberry Finn because of it. Dr. Alan Gribben, the Auburn University Twain scholar who's edited this new version, says he just doesn't want one word to keep students from reading a great book. Mark Twain wrote conflicts into Huck Finn's soul. Huck was a river kid of the 1830s who ran away from so-called civilized life with his guardian, Miss Watson. He throws in with Jim, a slave who's escaped Miss Watson and is trying to get to freedom. Huck and Jim run, rob, and scrounge together to survive. Jim refuses to run off when the going gets tough, and Huck refuses to betray Jim for a reward, even though his conscience reminds him that, under the law, Jim has stolen goods. All right, then, Huck screams at himself. I'll go to hell. As Mark Twain wrote in his lecture notes, a sound heart is a surer guide than an ill-trained conscience. I thought of that this week when the House of Representatives read the Constitution of the United States but dropped several sections that were later amended, like Article 1, Section 2, that classified slaves as 3/5 of a human being. Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland said, "We failed to show the American people that our ability to constantly improve on what the founders gave us is a blessing, not a reason for divisiveness." It's vital for artists of all people not to be sanctimonious. Art is supposed to puncture sanctimony. Conrad Kipling, Gilbert and Sullivan all wrote great works of literature in which they used the N-word when it was more slang than epithet. Editors and publishers often changed them through subsequent publications, arguing that their historical context had changed too. But take the N-word out of Huckleberry Finn and you take away a chance for students to learn and adults to remember the history that made the story daring and bold before it got labeled and shelved as a classic. This is NPR News.